What does innovation sound like? It sounds like the luxury of being in the moment with your customer, client, or patient. It sounds like having the right information right when you need it. It sounds like being at your best for your customers and your business. Thanks to Hyland's intelligent content solutions that improve digital processes, innovators everywhere are able to do their thing better, whatever that thing is. Now, who doesn't like the sound of that? Hyland, for innovators everywhere. Visit Hyland.com.
Joey, boy, don't be tempted to chase with me here. I was bricked.
The referee was absolutely shocking.
Subscribe now to the OTB Rugby podcast stream wherever you get your podcasts, or get the entire OTB catalogue on the OTB Sports app.
Hey, folks, and welcome. Like everybody else, I suppose during COVID, I've had a lot more extra time in my hands than I normally would. So I wanted to try and use it as productively as I possibly could. So to that end, I decided to record a short series of podcasts focusing on the whole area of coaching, not just in the GAA, but I'll have guests from a wide range of different sports talking about coaching in their own context. And it's not to portray myself as an expert or a guru, or I'm certainly not that. I'm a learner like everybody else. But I've always found great value in reaching out to other coaches in other sports and try to pick their brains and see if I could get a nugget or two that had helped me in my own coaching. It's also probably just about 10 years now since one of my boys was in Temple Street Children's Hospital for a few weeks. So I wanted to try and find a way, if I could, to help them out a small little bit with fundraising. Like everybody else, COVID is put a stretch on all of us. So there is no charge, and I'm not being paid by anybody for doing these. But my two main objectives are just to provide a little bit of thoughtful debate for coaches, and hopefully if people find some value in it, that maybe they'd see their way to donating a euro or two through the link below that'll all go to Temple Street Children's Hospital. Okay, so let's move on to today's guest is a man that I know really well, back from his days in 2002, 2003 with the Tralee Tigers. Russ Bradbird was a basketball coach at the University of Texas El Paso and New Mexico State, where he worked with legendary coaches like Don Haskins and Lou Henson. Don Haskins, who he speaks about, you know, really nicely here, was the guy that people would probably be most familiar with from the movie Glory Road, where he was the white coach who moved to Texas El Paso and won a national championship for the first time ever with five black players starting on the team. So Russ talks about him, and he talks about his own experiences going from Tralee to now being a writing teacher himself and playing the fiddle and different things. So I hope you enjoy it. There should be a bit of value in it for coaches. And let me know what you think. Just Russ, so we were talking about it beforehand. Just we're trying to maybe drill down a little bit into the whole coaching philosophy of different sports and different coaches. And you're somebody obviously with a fantastic background in coaching. You might just kind of take us through a little bit at the start of where you came from with your high school and on to North Park and just, you know, where you went from there.
Yeah, well, I was as you might remember, I was a terrible player. I never was able to make my high school team. And I had this crazy idea, well, I'll try and make a college team, which was which the odds were stacked against me, but I was lucky enough to make it through practicing my dribbling skills. I was I'm still a little bit OCD, you know, a little compulsive and obsessive. And so I practiced my dribbling skills like a maniac and was able to be sort of a walk-on, the sort of the last player on the bench at North Park College. But which is a Division III school, but we were Division III national champions. We were very good Division III. We beat the Division I teams that we played. I never got in. I scored 13 points in my career, but I was able to sit next to the coaches every game. I made a point, you know, some players sit next to the coach hoping they're going to get in the game. I knew I wasn't going to get in the game until the very end, because we won a lot of games by a lot of points, but I just sat next to the coaches and listened to them talk. And I got the idea pretty early on that maybe I could be a coach, partly because I love the game, but also because I just didn't want to get a real job. And honestly, Michal, I'm not being falsely modest when I say I was a terrible player. I was good at the dribbling drills and I could demonstrate them and wound up making a name for myself. But I was so bad that I got cut from the team as a senior in college. And in fact, made a foolish mistake. The coach, the day he cut me from the team, no one gets cut as a senior. You have to be terrible to be cut as a senior. But the day he cut me, he called me into his office and offered me a couple coaching shirts and said, we want you to help coach the team. But I was stubborn and heartbroken and wound up, it wound up taking me a couple of years to get in, you know, to begin my coaching career after that.
Right. And you cut as a senior because the quality of player got better, or you had this?
Yeah, there's, in America, you have to, you get the 4 years to play. Mm. And so when the graduating seniors leave, then they might bring in some new players. But on the, when in my third year, we won the national championship and we had no seniors, nobody graduated. Right. So they were able to bring in some pretty good freshmen, and I pretty quickly became obsolete. And they had hinted to me that this might happen and you should think about being a coach and that kind of thing. But I was very determined. You know, I can become very sort of narrow-minded in my focus. And I couldn't see past my own pathetic playing career at that time.
Okay. And you mentioned the dribbling there and how it's probably become your staple. Where did that come from, or that that desire to improve that aspect of your game, or where did that arrive from?
Well, it was mostly out of necessity, because I didn't have many options. You know, I wasn't going to become a good dunker at my size or a good rebounder. And I wasn't a terrible shooter, but I wasn't a very good shooter. And I was small. I was 5'11", which is small for, you know, which is tiny for basketball. And so it was a thing that just sort of a necessity thing. And, I'd been shown these dribbling drills, and it was a lot of coaches sort of did them as a little 5-minute warm-up, but I became obsessed with them. And now I know there's a limit to what you can do with it, that you can become great at all these drills, but if you can't do it in a game, well, for me, I wasn't going to do it in a game because I didn't have great speed or quickness, but I developed great hand speed from doing them over and over. And one day after I think I was done playing by this time, but a coach saw me do it and asked me to come and speak to his camp about dribbling. And he'd only just seen me do a little bit. And I had done it privately. I'd done the drills privately. And in fact, would practice with the lights out and blindfolded, right. Sometimes in the basement of the dormitories where we were living. And so I was quite good. I could dribble 3 basketballs, if you can imagine, and those kinds of things. But we'd practice blindfolded and I'd wear cotton gloves. We'd call them work gloves. I don't know what the Irish would call it. Just what you use in the garden.
I wouldn't be used to those, yeah.
Sure, if you're cutting the turf, what would you wear, though?
Raw hands. You wouldn't wear gloves. That's the difference.
Well, the Irish are tougher than we are. As we well know. And so I had this whole routine of things that I'd practiced by myself, but had never done them publicly. But I made a small name for myself going around to the summer camps and demonstrating these drills. You know, in retrospect, I didn't know it at the time, Michal, but in retrospect, I think one of the things that appealed to me about basketball is that you can practice alone. Mm. And you know, I would imagine, I don't know enough about Gaelic football to know, could you practice Gaelic football alone?
Yeah, you can, absolutely. It's a little easier with basketball because you're shooting at a hoop and the ball is going to come back to you. You kick it over the bar from 30 yards in football, you got to go chase the ball and bring it back out again. So it's a little bit more difficult.
There it is. It was, you know, like baseball would be hard to practice on your own and those kinds. I suppose in the individual sports, you'd be okay, golf. But I like the aloneness of it, the idea of that I could go by myself with my basketball and practice. And I think I enjoyed that part as much as the actual game itself, which, of course, looking, you know, moving, I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves, but becoming a writer, there's very much an aloneness to it. You know, you're not writing with 9 other people like you're playing basketball with 9 other people.
Yeah.
But the dribbling drills got people's attention, and it led directly to being hired by Don Haskins, the famous old coach at the University of Texas, El Paso. And he was a great defensive coach and very old school. He was very gruff and he smoked cigarettes and drank tequila, but what he was most famous for was he was the first coach to start 5 black players. Yeah. This is, you know, when I was 7 years old, but he started 5 black players and won the national championship. And so because of him, I also got very interested in not just the stories behind the game of basketball, but also in how sports can often be used for, you know, how socially relevant sports can become. which I suppose we can talk about, because I think it happens in Gaelic football as well.
For sure, yeah. Dan Haskins is an interesting one. That was the movie Glory Road, wasn't it? That's the popular movie that most people would have seen.
Glory Road was the movie based on it. They take a lot of liberties. The Glory Road, the movie, I think it's a fantastic movie. It's not true in many ways, but the idea was true that he did take. He had the five. It was actually his fifth season that he won the championship, and there was already black players. There was already two black players on the team when he arrived. One of them was the famous coach Nolan Richardson.
Oh yeah, yeah. So it's a good movie that people would have probably seen or heard of. But and how long were you there, Russ? How long were you working with Haskins?
I was there 8 seasons, and then went back to Chicago. And this is when I first learned to type and learned how to use a computer. I did a scouting service, I don't know if they would have it in Gaelic football, but sort of a recruiting report that the colleges subscribed to. I'd go around to the high school games and. But I learned to type and not to use one finger, but also I started becoming sort of more interested in the I think it's my door into writing, and maybe it'll happen for you too. Maybe there's a novel in you, Michal. But I realized that, as I was writing these scouting reports, I realized, geez, I just said this about that player that he was quick as a cat. I've got to come up with a different metaphor here. But that scouting service led to me coming to the job at New Mexico State, which is just a half hour north of UTEP, and they're big rivals. And so if you can imagine, well, it's like what your friend Pat Price did when he went from Demons in Cork to Neptune.
Yeah.
Or even on to, that sometimes you join the rivals and it really rattles everybody. And it did made, but anyway, and then I wound up at New Mexico State for 6 seasons.
Yeah, and I was with Lou Henson in New Mexico State. Yeah,
yes, and they were Haskins was old fashioned and stubborn, and Lou Henson was old fashioned stubborn, but they were very different in many ways. Haskins was sort of the power of negative thinking, that if you thought the worst and predicted the worst, that everything will turn out better than that you'll never be disappointed, and he also had an interesting idea, Haskins, that. In the locker room after the games, if we won, Don Haskins would just rip into everybody if we won. And if we lost, he would build them back up and say, I was really proud of the way you fought. And we hustled really hard. I thought we played really smart at times and those kinds of things. The problem was because we were winning so much in my time, at UTEP, we had very good team. We had very good teams at both places, but we were winning so much that all Haskins seemed to do was complain. I remember we would leave the locker room afterwards, and I would think, does he not know that we won that game? But then when we'd lose, he was much kinder. And the other interesting thing that Don Haskins did that I thought was that I tried to use as a coach, and I think would sort of be translatable to any sport, is that he was brutally hard on the players, but it was always, and he wasn't a cursor, it wasn't f-bombs and that kind of thing, but he was brutally hard. He was and was never satisfied with their effort, but it was always his dissatisfaction was always pointed at a group. He would never say, Kieran, you're playing like a damn baby. He would say, the whole bunch of you are playing, or all you guys in orange shirts. And so it was pretty simple psychology, Michal. You could just see the players get together then, and they would say, this guy doesn't think we can play defense. Let's show him, which is, of course, precisely what he wanted them to do. But I've seen it before over the years with other coaches where they would belittle one guy, and there's great damage that can be done that way. Occasionally, a guy might need it if he's being completely lazy or completely selfish. But with Haskins, I think it was a very calculated move that he was hard on the whole group, and the whole group didn't like him.
Yeah.
So there was no favorites. They all disliked him, and they were all would complain about him, but it was never. But they would it banded them together.
Yeah, it's fascinating, and yet the team was obviously very successful. Most of those teams were very successful. It's interesting there. You said about him, preparing for the worst or fearing for the worst. We had a goalkeeper with Kerry. I'll leave his name out of it for now. But when we used to be training really hard in the winter, and then it was tough stuff it was always a case of, you know, he was coming in there absolutely preparing for the worst possible session that we could possibly have. And his view was, listen, if it's better than that, then sure, we're winning. So that kind of mindset is very prevalent around the place still, that prepare for the worst and hopefully you won't be disappointed after that.
Well, and then working for Lou Henson at New Mexico State, they were almost exactly the same age, and they were both from Oklahoma, which, you know, they both came from very modest, you know, they were Depression era kids. But Lou Henson was completely optimistic that even after, you know, he would come in and after a tough loss, you know, he would smile when he greeted you. And I remember when I first met him, I thought, we'll see what he's really like after we lose. And after we lost our first tough game when he was coaching, he came in and with a big smile and said, hey, we can work. We can do a lot better than we did tonight. How many of you guys think we can do better? And they all raised their hands. And I think they were a little embarrassed and I think sort of stunned that there wasn't going to be a tongue lashing and that kind of thing. And so Lou was very, very optimistic. He didn't like to talk about the past, and he was much more upbeat, and he was much more interested in giving the players their confidence. Oh, the other interesting difference is Don Haskins thought that the players couldn't remember anything new during what we'd call sort of crunch time with a minute or two to go. He would just say, go out there and, you know, play hard and share the ball. Whereas Lou Henson would draw up a fancy play that we had never seen before. And I remember whispering to him, like, Lou, I don't think they can remember this. But sure enough, they went. So Haskins had little confidence in the players' ability to remember anything complicated. He always kept things simple. Whereas Lou Henson was very intricate and was always drawing up new plays. And yet both were successful. And so I do think, you know, what an important thing I learned, I think, is that there's more than one way, you know, more than one way to skin a cat. You know, there's more than one way to be successful. The danger, of course, is that I've heard it called being a cesspool of knowledge. Mm. Yeah. So Lou would be, I don't know if you remember Danny Fulton, that was the Belfast coach over there. I also, you know, I thought he had great dignity. He was a real gentleman and
classy.
Yeah, he's just a classy guy. And after the game, the game was over and he'd shake your hand. And Lou Henson was very much like that. Once the game was over, there was no more bad feeling. But also Lou could be very shrewd. Now you'll like this one. And I tried to get your man, Kieran Donahue, to do this. I don't know if he ever did it, but when the game was almost over and we were about to lose, Lou would whisper to the referee, maybe there's a minute to go or 2 minutes, and maybe the fellow was shooting free throws and there was a minute to go or 2 minutes, but we were down 10 or 20 points. There's no way we're going to win. Mm. Lou would go up behind the referee and say, Joe, you guys did a great job tonight. You treated us fairly. There was, you know, we've got no complaints. We lost fair and square. And the first time I heard him do that, when we were walking to the locker room, I said, Lou, now, why did you do that? The referees were terrible. Look, they shot twice as many free throws as we did. And he said, now, Russ, I'm trying to get ready for the next game, and I want the referees on our side. So I tried to get Kieran Donahue to do that, to go up, you know, who could be very volatile, as everyone in Ireland knows it. I wanted him to go up to the referees with a minute to go when they were sure to lose and say, I guess in Gaelic, there's just one or two referees, is there?
Just one.
We just won.
Yeah.
Well, the poor fella, he's got, no wonder Donahue's yelling at him, but it's not his fault. But you know, even in basketball, there's three referees and only 10 players, which is actually one too many. But so I wanted Donahue to go up to the referee and whisper and say, we lost fair and square. And, you know, we've got no complaints. You called a good game. Because I do think that one thing you don't want if you're the referee or the player is the referee angry and looking out for every little thing that you do.
Yeah.
So, you know, so I think that happens when, you know, I watched the one game. I actually happened to be there live by chance when, remember the time when Kieran Donahue got thumbed in the eye by the fellow from Dublin?
Allegedly, I do, yeah.
Well, I've watched it several times, and it's nice of you to say allegedly, but I thought Donahue handled it with great class and said, look, it's just part of the game. But I've always wondered, you know, if Donahue hadn't been so hard on the refs, if he would have got maybe more calls. I do think it's true. It's true with our wives as well, Michal. We're going to get more. we're going to attract more flies with honey than we're
going to. That's for sure. Can I just go back to just something you were talking about Haskins there for a second about that he didn't trust that the players would remember stuff in crunch time or whatever, and that his approach was maybe one of simplicity more than, you know, maybe Henson's one more complicated. Nowadays, you'd probably be talking about, you know, that approach is giving players a sense of ownership over the situation themselves, to maybe they don't have to stick to a rigid play to go and win a game, but that they actually have control themselves to say, okay, let's pick the best option here, and whatever presents itself and we go win a game. So there's people would see that as a bit of maybe brilliance in the simplicity as well, you know?
Well, I think that's always the struggle with coaches. I know it's always a struggle with me, is how much control do you insist on? Mm. And are you insisting on control just to have control, or is there a real reason for it? And when to give up control? You know, one of the things that it happened to me when I was coaching the Tralee Tigers is, I think the first year I was trying to control things a little bit too much. And of course, it was a disastrous season for a number of reasons, but one of them was my own ignorance, and one of the things that really helped me, and I talk about it this in the book, in Patty on the Hardwood, was sort of starting to believe that, particularly you three guys, John Tien, who at that point was in his 30s, and you in your early 20s, and Kieran Donaghy, that you understood in many ways better than I did. And so one of the things that really helped me was, you know, in learning the Irish fiddle, I was a beginner on the Irish fiddle, and it made me sort of understand, hey, we're all still learning here. And it made me sort of open up to think. And so in my second year, there was a lot of, I don't know, you might remember this, is there was a lot of, you know, that I would call guys over and whisper, you know, I'd whisper to you or particularly to you or Kieran or John Tien, like, should we stay in the zone or should we go man to man? And what should we do here? And even, I think there was a lot more give and take. You might not remember this, but I remember this very distinctly at Colester. I was sort of on you about whatever it was, rebounding or whatever. And you turned to me in the midst of the game and said, coach, that's enough. And I thought, well, first you were twice my size, probably. But I think if I was younger, I would have said, oh, Joe, get in there for me, a Hall Quirk. I don't like his big mouth. But there's an element of give and take, especially, and there's an element of give and take, particularly in basketball. I imagine it's in Gaelic football and a lot of other sports as well. But there's an element of give and take. And the challenge for me often was, you know, when to suppress my own ego, but also I think in some ways when to be stubborn and stick to your guns and when to bend. So for example, I remember when I worked for Don Haskins, he said, I'll never coach a goddamn guy who's got a tattoo. Well, you wouldn't have a team now. Yeah. And at one time, you know, Don Haskins was famous for, he would never play zone defense. But by the time I got to him, we played zone defense, you know, much more than, you know, maybe 30% of the time we would go to the zone, and it would frustrate people. And so I think that, you know, I think we all have to sort of figure out when to be patient and when to be stubborn. And I think it even happens on an individual level, is I'm going to be incredibly impatient with, you know, with Kieran Donaghy in some ways, but in other ways because I think if you're not impatient, no one ever gets better. Mm-hmm. If all you ever do is say, well, he'll get better someday, it's never going to happen, you know. But if you're too impatient, that can spoil things as well.
Going back to your own playing, when you admit yourself that you weren't the greatest player and you got cut as a senior, which was obviously probably a formative thing for you, you know, that's a huge, maybe embarrassing or whatever, you'd feel those emotions yourself. But do you think that those kind of things shaped or influenced your coaching as you went forward? That feeling of maybe that you weren't the best player, that you had a little bit more empathy for guys that maybe weren't the star guys or that were struggling a little bit more?
Well, I think it works. I think it did it in a very profound way, and for two different reasons. First, I think it made me more sensitive. You know, you might remember when I was coaching with Tralee, you know, I actually coached Super Dave Cronin and Kevin O'Donohue and Aiden O'Shea and guys who hadn't, and Alan Keane, guys who hadn't, up to that point, hadn't played much in the Super League. I was going to throw them out there because I was maybe a little too sensitive. I didn't want a guy to feel like, I'm here on the bench and not only do I not get my chance, I'm not even appreciated. I wanted to appreciate the eighth, ninth, and tenth man. But also, I think there's a long, I'm not the first one to say this, there's a long history of fellas who are great players that are so impatient with bad players that they can't, you know, they can't sympathize with what they're going through. And so it's the reason Michael Jordan would never be a good coach, or, you know, like, because, and I remember when I first started coaching, I remember a man named Tony Baroni, who died a year and a half ago. So he said to me, now, Russ, you've got to remember, not everybody's going to work as hard and be as dedicated as you are with the dribbling drills. And I thought, oh, of course they will. I'll make them be as dedicated, you know, but that, of course, you know, no, very few players were going to practice their dribbling as much as I did. But I do think that when you're as talented as, say, a Michael Jordan is, that you think everyone should learn quickly what's wrong with these dummies. And that can really work. So I think it's happened over and over again that, you know, good players don't make good coaches. It's sort of the secondary ones who do. For example, Don Haskins, you know, he wound up becoming ineligible as a player when he was a player. He was played for the famous old coach named Henry Iba, that was the American Olympic coach. But Haskins was ineligible at one point, wound up in and out of the games and on the bench. But I think that those guys that struggle a little bit wind up being able to sort of relate to the player's struggle.
Yeah. Interesting. And the dribbling, just back to the dribbling again, because you've referenced it a couple of times now. Where did the, like, I know you make the point that you weren't going dunking and you weren't the greatest shooter, and that dribbling was your maybe your key to being recognized as a player. But where did that motivation come from? Because as coaches, like, we want to fill people with that kind of motivation to if you're a young kid or you're a teenager or even an adult, that you can get out and you can go practice your skills, whatever sport it is, that we're giving them that kind of, not that we're giving it, because you can't give somebody kind of intrinsic motivation, but that they have that intrinsic motivation like you had to go and practice your dribbling so many hours a day. Where did that come from with you?
Well, yeah, I mentioned that I didn't make my high school team, and I should have said I never made my high school varsity, you know, the older team. But when I was a sophomore, I made the in Chicago, they call it the Froschsoff. And it's a really important example, I think, for me to remember is we were, you know, the older guys, the varsity team was down there doing their dribbling drills. And the Froschsoff coach, a man named Harvey Brouse, who I'm still in touch with, he pointed down to this little red-haired kid that was on the varsity. He was the best dribbler. He had, you know, he had an afro. He had a red afro, you know. He was a little Jewish kid with a red afro, but he was a good dribbler. And he pointed down at this kid named David Chalmers, who I've never again seen since high school, and said, you could become a great dribbler like he did if you just practiced these drills. He only said two things to me the entire year. I was such a bad player, but that one really stuck with me. And I think we have to be careful as coaches not to, you know, that, like, we don't remember everything we say to kids, but those kids remember everything that's said to them because of so few things that you're able to say to each player. And so it really does stick with kids. I think if you say, you know, that you're not worth a darn, or you should quit, or you're, sometimes we think that can motivate kids, but, and I suppose sometimes it could, but at that time, I think I was 14, right, and it really, really stuck with me. And so particularly what we say to children can really, really stick with them. And I've done it myself, Michal, where I've been said something I regretted, and I would always try to go back to the guy later, either call him that night or go to his home, you know, and say, listen, I think it actually shows strength. I don't want to talk about politics, but one of the things I admired about Obama was he's the first president I ever remember to say, I made a mistake. You know,
certainly not your last one.
No, you wouldn't catch the current guy doing that. But I think that great leaders are able to do that. I think it actually strengthens their position. You don't want to name too many of your mistakes.
Yeah,
and we wouldn't have time to name all of mine. But I think it actually shows strength that I made a mistake, and I've done it with my own daughter to say, listen, I'm sorry I yelled at you yesterday, or that kind of thing.
Yeah, listen, parenting is the greatest coaching experience you're ever going to find from my perspective anyway.
Would you believe when I'm parenting, I think about Don Haskins and Lou Henson all the time.
Really?
But you know, Lou was unflappable in his, you know, Lou Henson used to say, you know, and he always said it with a smile too, so I'll try and imitate him. He said, now, Russ, 90% of the problems in the world are caused by the tone of voice people use. And I think he's right about that. Is, you know, you've got to, you know, how, as a writer, I know that now is, you know, the words you choose, you know, or as a speaker, your tone is very important. As a writer, you know, words have real consequences. And if you call a player a dumbass or stupid, you know, it's very different than saying you're not thinking the way you know, the way you can, or that kind of thing.
But it's amazing. And it's a point well made. That something that a coach said to you, like, how long ago is that? You're gone from high school a long time, and it still resonates with you today. That thing shaped maybe your basketball skills in terms of the dribbling, and you're still recalling that story even now.
It really stuck with me. It was 1973, you know, and I still remember it. I still remember it. I wonder, Dave Chalmers wouldn't remember me, but I certainly remember him. But also, Michal, I do think some of it. I don't want to say it's genetic. But if you've got to, you know, like if you have to coach effort, I think one thing as a coach we never want to do is, and I would tell players this, is we don't want to coach effort and we don't want to coach unselfishness. Like if you've got a player who tries hard, who gives it a great effort and he's unselfish, there's no point in yelling at that guy. You know, you might as well just and it was also something you might not remember this, but in my second year in Tralee, we had Brandon Mason, who was very volatile. He played for Lou Henson, and you almost didn't need a scoreboard with Brandon Mason. You could just look at his face and say, okay, we're losing, or okay, we're winning. Well, at our first practice game, I yelled at him and said, Brandon, you know, damn it, that's your guy that went back door. And he yelled right back at me. And I thought, and he'd played for Lou Henson, and Lou had convinced me to take him. And I knew him a little bit beforehand. It was didn't take much convincing, but I left that day and thought, damn it, I'm going to have to send Brandon Mason home. I can't have the American player yelling at me. And then I thought, well, what am I going to tell Lou Henson that it was only a practice game. I couldn't call Lou Henson and say, look, we didn't even make it to the first game. I'm sending this guy home. But he had yelled pretty loudly, you know, the whole team had saw it. But then I just thought, let me try something different, which most coaches are stubborn and they won't do that. And I didn't always do that either. But the next practice, I went to next time Brandon screwed up at the practice, I went to him and I whispered. I said, Brandon, you're supposed to help on that. And you know what he did, Michal, is no one else heard it, but he whispered right back to me. And I thought, oh, aha. And I think one of the things that as coaches and as a teacher, I'm a teacher now, is you want everyone to think they're being treated equally, but you can't treat everybody equal. Mm. And so I know that, like, I remember when Mark Burnson took over in Tralee, and I think you responded well to him, and so did Kieran Downey, and so did John Tien. But some players, you know, he was much louder, and he would roar at guys much more than I, and a better coach. I mean, I'm not being falsely modest. He was a better coach than I was, but not everybody was going to respond to that. And I think for me, I just, with Brandon Mason, it really taught me a lesson. Like, you know, I got great results from whispering to him. So all year we were whispering back and forth to each other. You know, some players don't do well with being sort of the American black players would call it being fronted off by the coach, you know, like sort of being belittled by the coach. Some players need that. You know, like I think Tien wanted that, John Tien.
Yeah.
I think he wanted abuse, and that you would abuse him, and then he was going to go out and fight and show you how tough he was, you know, that he actually did well under that. And Donahue, you know, I think like with you and Kieran Donahue, it wouldn't matter. You could have a frog coaching you guys, you know, or, you know, whether it was the Bomber or Claudio O'Shea, you know, or Pat Price, you guys were going to respond to whatever coach, but not every player is like that. And I do think it's important as a coach, you can't just coach your star. You've got to coach the bad players, and the players need to think they're being treated equally, but of course we're not treating everybody equally.
Yeah, that's really interesting about the communication with Brandon. And like there's a big thing now, I suppose, as well, is just that coaches are aware that, you know, we're coaching people and not players. That distinction is that, you know, if you shout at Brandon Mason, for example, and he's not, you know, he doesn't react well to it or whatever, another form of communication or a quiet word to this guy where he doesn't feel like he's being challenged or demeaned or undermined, and now you're getting results and you start to get the best out of him. And it's probably that idea of getting to know people and the fact that you're relating to a person and not just a player who can deliver whatever it is on a basketball court or football pitch or rugby or whatever it might be, you know?
I think that's an important concept, but I think in some ways, maybe a more modern concept. I don't know. Was it Jack O'Connor that was the man's name from Cars of Eden that, he didn't seem like a yell and scream type like Paddy O'Shea would have been, but where I think we've gone off the rails, Michal, I will confess, I don't want to make anybody mad on the Kerry count on the Kerry panel, but here it is. I think it, particularly in basketball and particularly in pro basketball, is we've gone a little statistical crazy where there's all this computer analysis. And I think the hugely important thing that seems to ignore is there's a human element to sports that will never change. Is there's human beings involved, and because there's human beings involved, it can become very volatile. It's why the NBA continues to this day, and it'll never change. I'm not faulting anyone, but they draft the wrong fella. They've done all this homework and they've looked at all the statistics, but for chemistry reasons or personality reasons, a fella doesn't work out. And so but the human element will never change. Like, yeah, Kieran Donahue, he's a great player, but how is he going to react to Brandon Mason? Well, there's an unpredictable element to the human element to it that yes, psychology can get it, but statistics cannot get at. And so I know, like with John Tien, I think it was immeasurable with John Tien. Like, he might have one basket for the whole game, and then he'd make three baskets in the last 2 minutes and we would win. And now you could look at the statistics and say, geez, he only had 8 points. We need to get him out of there. But, you know, some of it is immeasurable.
Yeah, and it's a big jump to go from John Tien and Kieran Donahue to Tim Hardaway. But was it El Paso or it was UTEP? Sorry, yeah.
It was El Paso, yeah.
And that was probably the biggest fish you caught in your recruiting days, was it?
Michal, I wish I could tell stories about what a genius I was, but I saw him once at a playground, and the next day we called a YMCA, sort of the community center. And, you know, I was 23 years old and he was 18. And at that time I was still, even though as I've said, I wasn't a good player, but the second day I went and played with him. I went, played out on the court with him, and there was a real element of luck involved. But also, we talked about the unpredictability. Like, he wasn't rated very highly, and that made him really angry. He had a chip on his shoulder, not about race or class or anything like that, but he had a chip on his shoulder. These other fellas had gotten more attention than him, and he was convinced he was better. So when Hardaway came out of high school in Chicago, there was four or five point guards that were ranked well above him in all these scouting services, and for good reason. They probably were better, but he was determined to prove that he was better. And I think that was an important lesson for me to think you actually don't want the highest rated fella, because he's going to think he's got nothing to prove. And I've done that before, where you want kids from winning teams on your team. But I do think there's an element that, let's say if a GAA player has won the 17 and under championship, that he thinks, I'm done, I don't have to do anything else. And also, but to get back to the Tim Hardaway thing, I tell parents this all the time, is it shouldn't matter to you. You don't want your son to be the best 11-year-old or the best 13-year-old or the best. You want him to be, if he's in basketball, if he's the best 21-year-old, it means money. And if he's the best 19-year-old, it means a basketball scholarship. Being the best 11-year-old is useless. Mm. And in fact, don't you remember this from high school, Michal? It is the prettiest girls, 4 years later, they weren't the prettiest girls, right? Yeah. Or the fella, I remember when I went to grades, in primary school, there was a fella named Duck. We called him Duck. He was the best in football, basketball, and baseball. But by the time we got to be 18, he wasn't the best at all anymore. Mm. And I do think there's an element of, for parents, where they're so concerned about their kid being the best 11-year-old, but you actually don't want them to be the best 11-year-old. It just works. It just, for human psychology, you want kids that, you know, as a coach, I want kids on the team that are hungry and feel like they have something to prove.
Yeah. And that's an important point. And in every sport, in GAA, every game, This obsession with, you know, under 10s or you're under 11s and 12s and 13s, that we got to win this game, we have to win this league, we have to win this championship. When in all reality, the point you make is completely accurate, that realistically, a lot of those kids might not even be playing by the time they get to 21 or 22 because of maybe the pressures that they might have felt from parents or coaches or whatever to try and win those games. Maybe it's not something that's for them, but like, it's amazing that the kids that do come through at 18, 19, 20 years of age, who may not have been your star guys at 11, 12 and 13 years of age, if they're kept playing and if they're used, and the point you make about maybe guys who are lower on your roster, if they're made to feel that they're a part of the whole thing as opposed to just being kind of extras shunned out the back, you know?
But also, I think it's important to communicate to your team that, you know, sometimes, you know, positive motivation is great, but at times there can be negative motivation. I remember there's a famous story in American boxing where they asked Rocky Graziano, they asked Tony Zale. He would have these famous fights with Rocky Graziano back in the 1940s or 50s. And they asked Zale, did you hate, they were wars where they were just brutal fights. And they asked Tony Zale, did you hate Rocky Graziano? And do you still hate Rocky Graziano? He said, hate him. I love him. He drove me to greatness. And I would argue, I don't remember what year it was, maybe 2015 or whatever, but the MVP for Kerry when they won the All-Ireland that year should have been Joe Brawley.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Like sometimes, you know, you can think I'm mad at Joe Brawley, but Joe Brawley drove Kieran Donaghy to greatness. He should, you know, and I think they're friendly now. By the way, when I lived in Belfast for a year, I met someone said, oh, Joe Brawley's over at this fella's house. So I went over with my book, you know, and I signed my name on the page that had Kieran Donaghy's photo. And he took it well. He said, I misspelled Brawley. I can't remember, but I spelled his name wrong. But that idea, like, I think that happens. And I think it's something for the athletes to remember is you may think that was a terrible thing that happened to you. Like, I think, not to keep talking about Kieran Donaghy, but, you know, I know he had a troubled relationship with his father, but that drove him to greatness. You know, and one of the things it did for Donaghy was, I think as a young man, he was craving approval from an older man, and he wasn't going to get it from his father because he wasn't around. And so he had to get it from Jack O'Connor or Paddy O'Shea or from me or, you know, Mark Burnson, is that he was craving. And so I do think there's an element of, I know it happens to me as a writer all the time where I grumble and think these bastards, they rejected my book. And, you know, I think it's always a crossroads for us as players and coaches is what am I going to do? Am I just going to, there's time to quit. Like I'm never going to be an NBA player. I might as well quit my dribbling. But, you know, I think there's this crossroads we come to as coaches and athletes where we have a real reckoning, you know, where like it happened to me in Tralee where I couldn't sleep at night. And I would have rather had a night where I did sleep, but it forced me to sort of deal with some of, you know. So I do think it's out of crisis. And it happens in art and music, too, where it's crisis. You know, like it was sad and hard times that made the American blues music be what it is. And it's crisis, you know, like I think you as a football player or Donaghy as a football player have some dark times. Like, what am I doing on the bench and what am I going to do here?
Absolutely, yeah. And everyone has those times, but it's, I suppose, the way you react to those are the way that shapes your, whether you're a player or a coach or whatever. But it's interesting to hear you talk, though, about the underage stuff. I think that's a really important point about you don't have to be the best 11-year-old. You don't want your kid necessarily to be the best 11-year-old. We want kids playing the game as long as we possibly can, whatever game that is. And the longer you're playing, and you know, the better chance you have of sticking at it and getting better at it, you know?
And it's not just the possibility of who's going to grow and develop. It's if a kid has too much success at 13, he thinks it's going to be easy. Mm. You know, so you don't want, I think in some ways I always tell parents is until they're about 18 years old, the only thing you should say to them after the game is, did you have fun?
Mm. Yeah.
You know, it has to be fun or they burn out, I think.
Yeah.
I know like with you with basketball, I don't think you ever burned out. And I think Donaghy with Gaelic football, I don't think he ever burned out because his success didn't happen until later.
The fiddle for people maybe who wouldn't be, and I'll talk about it a little bit maybe before I set this off. But when you first came over, you started with the fiddle to learn how to play. I can remember bringing you down and dropping you outside Betty's and different places, and you'd go in and you'd sit down and you'd start to play the fiddle, which at the time we were all thinking this, you know, it's pretty unusual. It's a strange kind of a thing for an American guy to come over who's coaching basketball to be doing. But now, right now, I've started thinking about it and how interesting it is and how it's something like that can actually impact on a person's coaching as well. Like there was a hurling man over here who, as an adult who had never played golf before, to deliberately improve his coaching, to gain a bit of empathy for the children and the youths that he was coaching, took up playing golf. And it's a kind of a similar thing to you taking up the fiddle. He started playing golf and felt like a six-year-old child trying to make a layup or run and jump and catch a football or hit a slitter, that it was totally new and something to really completely try to learn from scratch. Like how did playing the fiddle, even though it probably wasn't the purpose of it, but how did it, you know, have an impact on your coaching?
Well, I think it's important to be a beginner at something. And so even though I played some American old time music, I was completely a beginner. And I'd sit there with my fiddle on my knee waiting for an hour to hear a tune that I knew. But I do think there were some similarities. Like in basketball, you go practice by yourself, then you go to the group and see, oh, geez, I can't make a left-handed layup or whatever it is. Well, the same thing happens in music where you practice by yourself. And then on Sundays, you go to Betty's or Bailey's Corner or Kate Brown's in Hartford and you see, okay, oh, here's what I'm good at, but here's what I'm not good at. And you go back and practice by yourself. But I think by having I'm not a Buddhist or a Zen guy, but there's this Zen Buddhist idea, they call it beginner's mind, where by being a beginner, and by learning, it really helped me to think, okay, I'm learning the Irish tradition, and I'm trying to teach the American tradition. I think there's an element to that. And I do think there's a few, there's not many, but there are a few, like Danny Fulton, I guess, the Belfast coach, was a very good piano player. And have you met, in Dublin, there's the hurling man named Mick O'Brien. Have you met Mick O'Brien? He'd be about my age, but he is maybe the best Illan piper in the world. Really? But, and he's the only music person that ever came to one of my basketball games, and he lived in Dublin. But his daughter and his son are actually my daughter's teacher now on the Skype. But that idea is, I do think there's an element of I think it works both ways. Is if you're learning something on your own that's, you know, that can help you teach something else. And there's also the idea that if you become an expert in one thing, it helps you to understand. There's also a sort of a Chinese, ancient Chinese idea that I know it seems like I'm a kung fu master or something here. I don't know anything about Chinese culture, but there is a Chinese expression that if you know one thing, you know the world. And so by becoming, say, a master guitar player, it helps you understand things in a greater sense. It's the reason we turn to books, is it sort of opens up our head to possibilities in the world. So I do think it's a hard thing to do. Like if you go and take, you know, karate lessons or piano lessons and you seem clumsy and clunky, but it helps you to understand. I remember saying this to Don Haskins, is that I remember being impatient with a kid once and complaining to him. I said, aren't these guys ever going to learn? And he stopped me and said, now, wait a minute, Russ. Now, how old are you now? At that time, I was 30 or 31. And he said, you know, you're 30 years old, but the players are always going to be 19. And I think one of the things that happens to all of us as coaches is we lose patience. Like, I'm tired of saying the same things over and over again, but the players aren't hearing the same things over and over again. They're new to it. Mm. And so I do think there's an element of, that you have to sort of remember that the players are new to it. And that, yeah, and it's important as coaches to remember, no, the players are never going to learn. You're going to have to keep teaching over and over again. And it happens to me in my writing classes now, like I think, God, I'm sick of saying the same things over and over again, but there's a value, you know, you have to do it. That's all, all we can do.
Yeah, I love that idea. Yeah, that it's important to be a beginner at something. It's probably a really good mantra for coaches, actually, to just whatever it is. What it doesn't necessarily have to be a sport or anything. Just it's important to be a beginner. I think it probably keeps you grounded as a coach, and it keeps that mindset that, you know, it gives you an idea of what players are going through a lot of the time if they're trying to pick stuff up, which is important.
Maybe for you, Michal, it's time to go back and really get proficient in your Irish.
Yeah, maybe.
Or the ballet, whatever.
Yeah, I think the Irish have a better chance than the ballet, yeah. Listen, last couple of things, and I'll let you get back to celebrating Joe Biden. If there was something, Russ, coaching-wise, that you have learned in the last 20 or 30 years that you wish you had known when you were starting out? What kind of growth or improvement or lesson have you learned in the last couple of years, 20, 30 years that you've been coaching that you'd love to have known when you were starting?
Well, I think I've more or less tried to do this, but I think with Lou Henson, you know, his thing was, you know, he treated everybody with dignity and treated every, like, I don't know if you remember Buddy O'Grady from the Mount Hawk. Mm-hmm. He wasn't the caretaker to me. He was just as important as John Tien or you. And I think just treating everyone with decency and dignity. And that I think, because especially the sports world is a small world, and if you're going to make enemies accidentally. And Don Haskins was very much like this too, as was Lou Henson. Is, you know, you're going to, you know, there's no point in going around making enemies, and it's a small world, you know, and that if you treat people decently and with respect, it's going to come back. And in the end, you're going to be happier anyway. I never met Pawdy O'Shea, but you know, that I think that there's, I think that you start rubbing people the wrong way or that kind of thing. And I think it's come back to haunt our president. Well, he's no longer our president as of today, I suppose, but you can't go around calling people names. And Pat Price and I used to talk about this all the time, is, you know, we have to build up the game itself and not just build up our team and build up. That was important to basketball, was having basketball get better and improve was more important than the Tralee Tigers improving or me having a winning record. Mm. And I think that in the end, I can't wait to see Super Dave Cronin and Kevin O'Donohue again. Like, I wanted to treat everyone with respect, and it'll come back rather than coming back to haunt you. I think it'll pay off for you in the long run.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. Yeah.
I'll give you one piece of advice yourself though, Michael. I will say in America, I don't know if it's true in Ireland, no husband has ever been shot while doing the dishes. So I hope that you'll take the time today to do the dishes yourself and make things better around the house.
Dishwashers, Russ, dishwashers. Listen, I just want to say thanks, Russ. We're gonna leave it there, and like it's been fantastic. It's great to catch up with you. I haven't seen you in a long time, so it's great to chat. And I think some of the stuff that we got there is really good. Just would you mind, Russ, just for people, if people, like, because you've got a couple of fantastic books and different things. I didn't even get to mention Sean Harrington, and if you might just mention a couple of books, Russ, and where people might be able to get a little bit more information about you if they wanted to.
Well, it's, let's see, if you can spell my name, it's russbradbird.com. There's just one S in Russ, R-U-S-B-R-A-D-B-U-R-D. russbradbird.com has information about my four books, and including the most recent one about gun violence in the world of basketball in Chicago. We've got a terrible gun violence problem in America. But I suppose Patty on the Hardwood and all the books would be available. Do we get Amazon? We get Amazon in Ireland, do we?
Yeah, we do. We do. We get Amazon.
And,
yeah.
And so I don't know if O'Mahony's what are the other retailers for books?
Eason's, all of them. We have them all. Yeah, we'll find them.
What's the name of the little one that's just around the corner from Jess McCarthy's pub in Tralee?
Is it Polymath?
Yeah, Polymath. I don't know if Polymath would carry my books or not, but I would always encourage people to use their local bookstore rather than, you know, I buy from Amazon occasionally, but I always try to do it. That's always my last resort.
Yeah. Okay. What about Sean Harrington? No, you okay with Sean? Do you want to mention that?
Well, yeah, he was, we're coming up on the 7-year anniversary of his shooting, and we finally got him. So I wrote a book about him called All the Dreams We've Dreamed, a story of hoops and handguns on Chicago's West Side. I'd coached him briefly at New Mexico State and was out of touch with him, but he was driving his daughter to school at 7 a.m. This was, again, 7 years ago. And he was in a rental car, you know, so it wasn't his usual car. And so these fellas, in a mistaken identity, they ran up and opened fire on him, these two young guys. It was 7:30 in the morning, which I thought, none of us are safe if they're shooting at 7:30 in the morning. Turns out, you know, it's heroin sales, that if you're buying beer or marijuana, you don't care what time it is. But if it's heroin, you need your hit of heroin early. So they ran up, they had the wrong car. And when the bullets started flying, he dove on top of his daughter and pushed her down, a bullet went through her headrest. So he saved her life. She would have got hit in the face or the head, but he took a bullet in the spine and he'll never walk again. And that's, so that all happens in the first chapter of the book, but the book is about that incident, but mostly about his struggles afterwards, and about many of his players wound up getting killed after he was shot. And so it's a huge problem in America, and it's not a simple solution. I don't know what the solution is, and the book is not about the solutions or policy, but just about the people involved. And so all of my books are available, but online. But Sean Harrington, who spells his first name not the Irish way, but S-H-A-W-N. And I suppose Harrington could be an Irish, the surname could be an Irish name too, I suppose.
Yeah, one of our most famous golfers, Padraig.
Well, that's right. I'd say they're not related, but Sean is African-American, of course, but it's quite a story of courage and perseverance. And it also made it, you know, writing about Sean and you know, sort of documenting his life made me appreciate Terry O'Brien, you know, our Lord Mayor in Tralee, who's been confined to a wheelchair, and just the struggles and guts that it would take to go on every day, and the prejudices you face and that kind of thing. So it really, I haven't seen Terry O'Brien in a few years, and I always admired him, but now it's given me an understanding of what he faces.
Yeah. And he's doing good. I've spoke to him recently, actually. Yeah, he's in great form, even with COVID and everything. So listen, we're gonna leave it there, Russ. I wanna thank you sincerely, man. I really appreciate it. And I think people will enjoy that and get something from it. And and again, just before we go, guys, there is going to be a link below again, and everything that if you have something, if you've got a couple of cents or a euro, and you feel like donating something, it's going all directly to Temple Street Children's Hospital in Dublin. And especially now during COVID, fundraising, everything else has been severely hampered. So if there is something that you can donate, then obviously it would be most appreciated by them and by everybody. So thanks again to Russ, and talk soon.